It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
They did away with the governor's role in the selection of judges and made the election of judges strictly by the legislature without a recommendation. Now, at that point in time, in 1870... Since that point in time, there has been no change.
Article 5, Section 14 of the Constitution describes the duties and compensation of lieutenant governor. It says the lieutenant governor shall be president of the Senate, but shall have no vote except in the case of an equal division, a tie vote. Does that mean every vote?
Senior Justice of the Supreme Court of Virginia, Elizabeth Lacey, tells us how judges are chosen in Virginia. And private attorney Lane Needler, a former Chief Deputy Attorney General of Virginia, explains when the lieutenant governor can break a tie vote and when not. And during this week's News You Can Use, you'll learn how a bank that was too big to perform now has to pay $7,500 in sanctions for its delay in paying a $70,000 settlement. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 187, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. A bank that paid $70,000 to settle a defamation action after mistakenly starting foreclosure proceedings against a Rockingham County woman has been ordered to pay an extra $7,500 for its delay in delivering the settlement checks. U.S. Magistrate Judge Wall Krigler found Bank of America willfully failed to comply with both the terms of the settlement agreement and the court's orders when the bank took 55 days to pay the plaintiff and her lawyers after reaching a settlement. The judge ordered the bank to pay $7,500 to the plaintiff's attorneys for fees incurred in pursuing the bank's performance of the settlement agreement and the court orders. The settlement amount had been confidential until the bank submitted copies of internal emails at a hearing on the motions for sanctions. The emails detail that payment was to be made in two checks, one to the plaintiff for $35,000 and the other to her lawyers in the same amount. When the bank finally delivered payment, it was in a single check. The plaintiff's lawyer had to make arrangements at a local branch bank to have two cashier's checks issued. The underlying case began with Bank of America's approval of a loan modification plan for homeowner Laura Summers. She paid as directed, but the bank mistakenly rejected her participation and started foreclosure proceedings. Even though bank representatives told Summers she was correct, no one could seem to stop the ongoing foreclosure process. At the last minute, her lawyers had the foreclosure stopped. The bank went ahead with the modified loan for Summers. After negotiation with her lawyers, the bank agreed to pay $70,000 to resolve her lawsuit for defamation, fraud, and other claims. Tom Domonoski of Harrisonburg, who represented Summers, said that a Bank of America paralegal who served as contact with local bank counsel could not be contacted for 2 weeks after the settlement was completed. The judge said it appeared the bank was, quote, too big to perform, according to Domonoski. The judge also was critical of the bank using a paralegal to give direction to lawyers and found the violation of the various payment deadlines was as willful as you can get. Domanowski added that the bank seemed to have few people qualified to make decisions. If you don't have well-trained decision-makers with the authority to solve problems, you get into trouble, he said. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. Senior Justice of the Supreme Court of Virginia, Elizabeth Lacey, explained how judges are chosen in Virginia in a talk given at the Library of Virginia on September 21, 2012, and the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show was there. Here are Justice Lacey's remarks.
I'm going to talk just a little bit about the history of the court, but particularly the history of judges and the judicial branch. As you all know, the judicial branch is a third branch of government, supposedly an equal branch of government, which is up for debate in some areas. But the Constitution of Virginia, as in every other state, is extremely important to the judicial branch of government because in every state, it's the Constitution, state Constitution, which prescribes how judges become judges in each state. And the reason that that is so important is that the concept of judicial independence is very closely tied to the way in which a judge gets to be a judge. In 1776, judges in Virginia were appointed for life by the General Assembly. And that continued for quite a number of years until 1850, in fact. The legislature changed the Constitution and moved the selection of judges to a popular election by the populace, voting for judges, which, of course, in Virginia seems very strange at this point. But judges were elected in popular elections, and they served 12-year terms or 8-year terms, depending on what court they were in, and they were up for re-election. And they ran for election just like every legislator, delegate, senator, or federal officer would. That didn't last too long. That only lasted for about 14 years. And they reverted. I don't think they were spending millions of dollars on campaigns, but the legislature took back their right to select judges. At that point, judges were nominated by the governor and then elected by the General Assembly, much like the federal judges. Even though it still was a term, not a life term, but a term of years, much like the president nominates and the Senate confirms, in Virginia, the governor would nominate and the legislature would then elect from that nomination. That actually even lasted less amount of time. That only lasted for 6 years, and in 1870, they did away with the governor's role in the selection of judges and made the election of judges strictly by the legislature without a recommendation. Now, at that point in time, in 1870, since that point in time, there has been no change in the way judges have been elected in Virginia. So that process has existed in Virginia for over 140 years. Kind of sounds like there's not a lot of turmoil about that. I do want to qualify, however, that as many of you might know, and I'm a product of this too, is if there's a vacancy on the Supreme Court or on the Circuit Court or the Court of Appeals, the governor may appoint if the legislature is not in session. But that appointment is only good until the legislature comes into session, and the individual must be then elected by the legislature for the full term. And in fact, that was basically what happened to me on both the State Corporation Commission and the Supreme Court. There has been no change. However, in the 70s, nationally, there became a very big concern over how judges were getting on the bench, again tied to this concept of independence, judicial independence. At that time, approximately 39 states elected judges in some way, many of them by popular partisan elections. So there was a movement around the country to have what was called a merit selection with retention elections. The purpose of this was to take politics out of the appointment of judges or selection of judges. In merit selection, there would be a group of people appointed maybe by the legislature, maybe by the governor, maybe a combination. And that panel would nominate or select a judge for each one of these positions. Sometimes then the governor had to choose someone from that group. That person would serve and then would be up for a retention election after a certain number of years. No one would be running against the person. It would just be, in other words, the concept was they would be reviewed on their merit. They would get the position on their merit, and they would be reviewed by the people on their merit. So there were a number of states, about 24 at that point, that moved to this selection commission, a merit retention type of thing. There was quite a bit of discussion in Virginia from the 70s, late 70s, all the way up through the 80s, and many attempts to try and change it to a merit selection. Again, with the thought that it would remove the judge from any pressure or the politics. Because remember, as I said, in Virginia, you are elected by the legislature. At one time, not so much now, but at one time, many legislators were lawyers. Many legislators appeared before judges. And there was a real concern that both the method of getting on the court, having the legislative support, and then the very active number of lawyer legislators, that there was at least gave the impression of bias, or perhaps not the independence, the appearance of independence that people wanted for their judiciary. That effort truly was not successful. It kind of ebbed and flowed, and I know the bar was very, very active in trying to impose merit selection, and it just never happened. And in fact, since the 1970s, when a lot of states moved to merit selection, we've seen across the country real attacks on that method of selection. And in fact, in about at least 7 or 8 states now, it has been repealed. And it has also happened that where it does still exist, judges that run for retention, unopposed, just return me to my job, have been defeated in many states because they didn't like the decision that a judge made in a particular case, or that the court that the judge was sitting on, 1 of 6, 1 of 7, on an appellate court, there was quite a bit of pushback on the particular decision that was made. So the experiment with merit selection and retention, while certainly a noble one, has not panned out entirely the way those who put it together initially thought. Perhaps there are a number of reasons for that, not the least of them being the money that was put into elections, not only in straight-out popular elections, but also in merit retention elections. Just to give you a little idea, between 1990 and 2000, approximately $83 million was spent by judges on courts to get elected. Between 2000 and 2009, not even a whole decade later, that number has jumped to $206 million. Of that, at least at the last numbers that I saw, almost $40 million comes from interest outside the locality where a particular judge is running. So the influence of making elections for judges in the same category, in the same type of elections as the city council, as a delegate, as a senator, has really been influenced by money and the hinge that goes with that in terms of continuing independence of the judiciary is one which certainly is not very positive in retaining the confidence of the public. You know, Virginia is pretty unique in a lot of different ways and prides itself as not being California or not being anybody else. But our system of selecting judges has truly withstood the test of time. And it is the only method in the country that's like this. In South Carolina, legislators elect judges, but they must choose from a panel of which they receive from a kind of a qualifications commission. Unlike Virginia, where if you want to be a judge, you just sign up with the Courts of Justice Committee. Now, it's not quite that easy. It certainly is very open. It's certainly a non-discriminatory way. Of course, there is a mandatory retirement age right now. There also are provisions in the Constitution, but statutes elaborate on it, about judges with disabilities and ways that you can handle it. I do want to make one point, though. that has crept into Virginia rather substantially in the last decade. And that is that it isn't so much how the judge is selected in Virginia, it's how a judge is retained. Because for years, a retention to be reelected was, you know, if you weren't disabled and you didn't have any drug habits or anything like that, and you had good demeanor and all that, you could be reelected. Now it is not unusual for a judge to be told by his or her local representative that, you know, judge, you're a good judge. I like you. You're my friend. But, you know, we're not going to reappoint you. But we're not going to reelect you because there's someone from a different party that we want in, something like that. This has become probably the most troublesome part of our selection system because the reason that it's troublesome is because it discourages people, good people, from wanting to undertake the role of a judge and to run to be a judge.
You've been listening to Senior Justice of the Supreme Court of Virginia, Elizabeth Lacy, speaking about how judges are chosen in Virginia at a talk given at the Library of Virginia on September 21, 2012. We'll be back in a moment. At that same talk at the Library of Virginia on September 21, 2012, Private Attorney Lane Needler, a former Chief Deputy Attorney General of Virginia, explained when the Lieutenant Governor can break a tie vote and when not. Here are Mr. Needler's remarks.
I'm going to pick the example of the Lieutenant Governor's power to break tie votes, since that came up this session and Dick and I worked on it the last time it came up in 1995. This falls under the category of things aren't always what they seem to be. And just like a statute, when the Constitution's not clear, somebody's got to interpret it. Article 5, Section 14 of the Constitution describes the duties and compensation of Lieutenant Governor. It says the Lieutenant Governor shall be President of the Senate, but shall have no vote except in the case of an equal division, a tie vote. Does that mean every vote? As I tell my students in my legislation class, one of the things you've got to know is what vote's required for each bill. And what do you do when the Constitution or the rules of one of the houses says it takes a majority of the members elected? Majority of the members elected. And you have a tie vote, 20-20 in the Senate. Can the Lieutenant Governor vote? It says, shall have no vote except in the case of an equal division. 20-20 is an equal division. It doesn't say, unless it says it requires a majority of the members elected. It says kind of whenever there's an equal division. Lieutenant Governor is found in Article 5, which is the executive article of the Constitution. So how in the world can he be a member of the Senate? Well, Dick and I were asked this question back in 95, following the 95 election, which took out, among others, Hunter Andrews. The Senate Rules Committee, which was, and this turned out to be a problem, still a majority Democratic in the fall of 95, soon to switch to a tie Senate, and the question was, what are we going to do? We were retained to research the question, went into this project saying, this is easy. He's not a member-elect. He can't break every tie vote. He can't break ones where it says it requires a majority of the members elected. So we proceeded to do our research. And in that research, I'll never forget this, the Constitution of 1850 mattered because it was the one which, as with judges, enacted the current lieutenant governor structure. So we went and did research, and the person who is now the managing partner of our Richmond office was a young associate who was sent to the bowels of the Richmond Times-Dispatch to do research in the RTD. Back then, they ran a daily version of what happened at the Constitutional Convention, purportedly a transcript, probably not, but we used it. Unfortunately, nothing helpful in it. I wish there had been But there wasn't. There were no cases in Virginia. There were a couple of opinions that were very perfunctory, AG opinions that were not very helpful. So we looked at what happened in other states. We found 9 cases. 3 went one way, 3 went the other, and 3 didn't matter. I can remember the session when we sat down and said, oh, now what are we going to do? And we said, well, let's go back, and we walked through, what do you think the expectations would have been? And one of the things we continually came back to from this state and others was people wanted a way to move forward and break ties. So ultimately, we concluded the lieutenant governor could break every vote. It didn't matter what it said. The only one that really mattered was majority of the members elected, because that's what's required for the budget. That's what's required for judges. And so we submitted this document to the Senate Rules Committee. And at that time, Don Beyer was the lieutenant governor. I remember getting called into Senator Bo Trumbo's office. He was a Republican senator, now a judge, out in the Roanoke area. And Bo said to me, Lane, this is a wonderful piece of work. I just don't like the result. I said, well, Bo, in a couple of years, it may be okay with you. And of course, a couple of years later, we had a Republican lieutenant governor. So they've been very happy. It came up again this year. And the lieutenant governor decided, I know he had our memo, and I know his staff read it. And he decided he was going to say he could vote on organization, but that he could not vote on things like the budget and judges because it said majority of members elected and he wasn't a member elected. I think, respectfully, he was wrong. I think it was a very smart decision politically. It allowed him to help his Republican colleagues organize, and there was no question in any of our minds if the Democrats had sued, they would have lost. And they did sue and then eventually dropped the case. And that allowed him to vote on organization and then step aside. I think that was very smart for a lot of reasons. Again, there is no answer in the document. There is no answer from our colleagues on the Supreme Court. So it was not an unreasonable position to take. Now, how did politics resolve this? It got resolved the first time because Virgil Goode, a then Democrat, said to his colleagues in the caucus, if we don't work something out, I'm going to organize with the Republicans. So they did. They worked out a power-sharing agreement that lasted that 4 years and carried over for the next 4. In my own judgment, I'm speaking only for myself, I think that's one of many reasons that we don't see the type of partisanship in the Senate that we do in the House. They learned to play in the sandbox together, and they did it very well, I thought, for those, especially the first 4 years. This time around, the politics obviously were a little different, and Lieutenant Governor Bowling resolved that himself in a way that made it workable politically. So problems like this can be resolved by litigation, and there are cases out there where serious constitutional problems involving the branches have been solved by litigation. It can be solved politically. It can be solved just by plain old advice. If the Division of Legislative Services puts a gray jacket on a bill, that's a signal that they think it's unconstitutional. And it's a perfect reason for individuals to say, I'm not going to support this bill. We've got lots of bills before us. Why should I take the time supporting a bill that is very likely to be challenged, and if challenged, is likely to be found unconstitutional?
You've been listening to Private Attorney Lane Needler, a former Chief Deputy Attorney General of Virginia, speaking about when the Lieutenant Governor can break a tie vote and when not, at a talk given at the Library of Virginia on September 21, 2012. This is the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid radio show ever broadcast is available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. Most people don't know you can be fired for any reason at all. Good reason, bad reason, true reason, false reason, or no reason, as long as it's not a prohibited reason. Join us next week when private attorney Phyllis Katz explains employment at will and the limited exceptions to it in a rebroadcast of a show originally heard on June 1, 2011. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright. My Lord.